5.
No. Okay, good. Okay, so I need to just flip on this one, flip over to that one there, so I can see what's going on. Okay. Excellent. So welcome to tonight's live call, Friday 27th of February. Start off just by saying I'm here to help as I start off with a live call. Okay, so I'm here to help. Email me, WhatsApp me. I know one or two of you still haven't sent through the, use the advantage of the assessments, but I'm sure you will do when you're ready. Erica, just waiting for that one video from yours. But that's fine. But that's just to confirm what I think I already know. And some of it won't be a surprise to you anyway, but that's fine. So just to say, really, I am here to help. That's the advantage of being a founder member. Please take advantage of it. So today, just run through some very quick updates. Primary topic for today is running technique. And actually, it's such a massive subject, even bigger really than strength, as it turned out, as I was starting to kind of make my notes and all of this, that I'm going to do probably the next two, if not three, live calls on this, because I think whilst there was really only one question today, and you might have questions after it, I'm sure after today you'll have other questions. So, you know, and we'll just, and it also is quite good because it, running technique is one of those things that I think, you know, when you look on the internet, people are still going on about this, so many different things that are quite, they either don't matter anymore, very historical, that people still talk about. It's really confusing. There is so much information, and some of it's just legacy information is just out there because people don't know any better, so they're just regurgitating it, and they're actually not looking at some of the up-to-date research, up-to-date coaching experiences, etc. So that's going to be our primary topic. Then I'll cover any questions that we have. So updates, just some small updates really. The new content for January and February is the podcasts episodes. I'm really enjoying doing the podcasts. I know Mark said he's enjoyed them. I don't know if anyone else has kind of listened to them. Hopefully they're getting a little bit more refined as I'm doing them, a little less waffly. But I love it because I can just talk. I do most of them as one take. So I do write a framework of a script and then just kind of follow that a little bit and then just talk. So I've done a mini series on expression under load, which is really where my specialism is. It always has been, but it's now much more formalized. And that's really going into why do we lose form in terms of running? Why do we lose form when we're tired? Why can't we perform the way we want to? And this whole thing is, you know, you can build capacity, as we talked about last week, in the strength course, you can build as much capacity as you like, but that doesn't always translate across to your running. And so we have to look at why that isn't the case. And that's kind of where I've always been really had an interest in, but it's just a bit more formalized now. And then of course I've got the Portland Coastal Marathon recap, which is really funny because when I ran with Mark on Monday or Wednesday, it might've been whichever day it was, he was saying he'd listen to it and he said, "God, I can't believe you look at things in so much detail." He says, I just run. I don't care. I just run. It didn't even enter my head. I'm listening to you talking about the paces we were doing and this and we were doing and this and that. And it's just, we're so chalk and cheese in that respect. And I guess that's why it's quite good running together in that bit, because he just runs, whereas I'm kind of overthinking it in some bits, maybe that's why I've never been injured and he has been. So it's two sides to that particular one. So anyway, so that's the new content out. There is another two episodes of the podcast which I just haven't got around to recording yet. So I'll get that out probably either next week or the week after. The Strength for Runners course is underway. It follows last week's live call quite a lot, but I wanted to present it slightly differently. Same with the Brain Endurance Training course. Again, that's underway. They take a bit longer because I want to try and make it really useful for you, not just information there. And that's what's the hardest bit. How do we take a really complex topic and make it applicable so that you can actually use it in your running, not go, "Oh, that's interesting," and then just kind of ignore it. I want it to be so you can put it into actual practice and you get your benefit from it. So it just takes me a little bit longer than I think sometimes to write these things. So anyway, that's all underway. I'm also always in the background. I'm always looking at how I can improve the membership in terms of, because my vision for the Runner by Design membership, which is why it's called Runner by Design, was no matter where you are on your running journey, you can go into it, you follow the process for whatever your goal is at that time, and it will help you get to that goal. Okay, that was always my vision of how it should work. And having lots of courses is okay, but it's reliant on you guys then to find your way through that. And I've tried to kind of guide it as much as possible. What I really want to do, and what I'm developing at the moment in the background, along with some of the AI stuff, but it's just turning out not to be as reliable as I wanted to, but to try and get a simplified system in place, following the neuroactive method of identify, clean, train, integrate, strengthen, is that you can go in wherever you are and you can follow that process, and it will give you the exercises and the drills that you need to do, to, like, send you down a particular track of the lowest hanging fruit, so the best way of you getting a result, and you can pop back into it at any point and it will know your progression. So that's what's happening in the background at the moment. So just to give you kind of an idea where that's going, that's the grand vision. And we're getting there. It's just neurology is such a complex thing. So running technique. My views of running technique have changed an awful lot since I started running. I started running when I was 38 years old, so a little while ago now, 16 years ago. And I had run a little bit before, but not really for the last long, long time. I hated running at school. I hated that whole environment. I just didn't really like running. I did a little bit, I think, in my late teens. But other than that, it wasn't a sport I really liked. So I took it up because we were having the twins, and I was overweight and I was unfit, and I had to do something. And I just saw a poster coming out of the hospital for a charity run, and that's kind of where it all started from. And because the charity run was six or seven weeks away, somewhere around about that, and I had to literally teach myself from ground zero, and I did. I taught myself how to run, and I used the available information that I had. I bought some books, this, that, next thing, and I just went out and did it. And then I realized after I'd done that race, I never really looked back in terms of I really enjoyed it. And I carried on teaching myself how to run, thinking that's what everyone else did. Technique, cadence, all the things in those days that were coming out as really important, but then discovered that nobody else did. And that's how I got into coaching, because I wanted to share my experience and my journey to show the ordinary everyday person who was in the same position as me that actually they could achieve that as well. And that's why I started coaching. And Run Teach was set up in 2018 because I couldn't find anything satisfactory in the local area, or even really nationally particularly, that taught the ordinary person that we could get a good running assessment, you know, assess your technique. You could either go to a physio and you could have a physio version of a running gait analysis, which pretty much would pelvis down, and that was about it. You go to a foot specialist, pretty much ankles and feet. Or you could go to a running store, and again, that was for the purpose of selling shoes in the moment. So they would assess your gait. It's a lot better now, but even still, it's still the same. It's pretty much still knees down. And it's about selling you the shoes in a helpful way, but selling you the shoes that you need to have now for how you run now. It's not about, okay, well, we can help you improve. And there was nothing really about like that. So that's why I started Run Teach back in 2018 was where I really launched it. And that was what I wanted to do. But then it got really frustrating because you read all the stuff about running technique and angles and this and that, the next thing. But it came quite apparent to me as I was teaching people that actually a lot of that doesn't matter. Because if you can't do that movement in the first place, and that's really came to the forefront when I did the workshops, and I would teach people in the workshops. Anyone came to the workshops in those days, but you always used to get a venue at a field out by the Memorial Centre in the hall in Verwood. So we had the playing fields there, and then we used to do some down, a couple down in Poole where we had a big field we could run in, and also down at the one of the schools there that had the playing fields. So I would actually, part of that workshop, I would teach people how to do running technique, and they could all do it. Nice high heel lift, nice tall posture, you could all do it. But then as you go and see them out running a couple of weeks later, and they're back to where they were. And this is why COVID, I suppose, helped, because I had to shut the company down during COVID. It helped because I could then focus on finding out why was this the case. And this is why I went down the neurology route. So when we look at running technique, we have to look at I think it's changed a lot over the years in terms of what the research tells us, but also I think it's changed a lot because the average runner has changed a lot. So back when I started running, there was still a lot of, there was a lot less recreational runners. There was still a lot more competitive runners. So when you go to a race, I would aim to be somewhere above halfway in the top third of that race when I was running quite well. Now it's quite hard not to be in that because there are so many people behind you. So the whole thing has changed. And I saw a thing on the internet. It was the Running Week. Some of their stuff is absolute garbage, but some of it's kind of all right. And it said, it was saying, is it okay to walk a marathon? And of course, you can imagine all the comments about that. Oh, don't say I can't walk a marathon. Don't say I can't do this. Isn't that what Jeffing's all about? And Jeffing, I know he just passed away. Jeffing wasn't about that at all. Jeffing was a completely different thing. It's not about not doing the training and just walking because you can't be bothered to do the training and using it as a fallback. And I think running has changed a lot and running technique has changed a lot with it. So when you look at the research and some of the reviews of the research on running technique, they're looking at a different type of runner. I think we have to take that into account as well. But one question I'd want to kind of put across to you guys is, how do you know what is good running technique? Okay, so what is good running technique? When you look at another runner or when you look at videos or photographs of yourselves, what do you see? What do you feel? What do you feel about yourself? What do you feel when you look at somebody else when you're running? One of the skills I have is I can look at a runner, I can kind of feel, as well as observing technique, I can kind of feel their technique, which is kind of maybe a bit weird, but that's kind of puts me in that position. So how do you know whether someone's got good running technique or bad running technique?
Can I start?
I would say when it looks fluid, when it looks effortless, you see some of these athletes when they're running, and it just, no matter what stage you are in the race, it just looks effortless.
Nice, like that, yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say the same, but also it looks easy. They don't look like they're trying that hard. They are trying hard, but they make it look easy. It just sort of flows.
Yep.
And I would just add to that, because I would have said easy as well, but also they're upright. When I see pictures taken of myself on races, I collapse. I can see that how my form is very different to other people. So I would say a good runner is moving forward, and it feels like, yeah, they feel upright. They look relaxed and yeah. Rather than collapsed and tired.
Yeah, okay, that's good. So relaxed, upright, effortless, looks easy, light on their feet perhaps would be another way of describing some of those things. So good movement fluidity. Okay, well, that's good. And that's right. And what was really good to hear, there wasn't anything specific within that. It was those things. And I think that's really important because I think it's very easy. And if you do internet searches on running technique, you know, you'll get lots of different views. You'll get the bio mechanists who will look at it from an angles perspective. It's got to be this angle. It's got to be that angle. It's got to be this, that, the next thing. But to me, that's way too much detail. Most runners don't need that. In fact, I would say no runner needs that, because if you look at elite runners, they're all run differently, but they all have those qualities that you talk about. So I think that's really important. If you look at it from the perspective of somebody who, so you've got a biomechanics view, you've got a sort of personal trainer view of it, which is about power and running as hard as you can. In the US, a lot of it's about sprinting, so it's about how much power you can put down. And it's very specific about some of the things. So if you're trying to run, if you're trying to learn running technique from a lot of the stuff, information you can find on the internet, those global things that you just talked about aren't necessarily where they start. And that isn't necessarily the end point either. It's about, they go into way too much of a bit of a detail So I, when I first started learning to run, I looked at chi running, pose running. They were the big things at the time. And there's elements of those that are brilliant, but there are elements of it that's just way too detailed. And if you can't have a nice upright posture, lean forward from your ankles and balance well on one leg, pose running is absolutely no good for you whatsoever. It just doesn't work. And I think this is why people struggle a lot. And I think the change in the style of the runner has a big impact on that as well, because we're not as dedicated as going back into the 70s, 80s and 90s. Most of the people that were running, that's what they did. They put all their effort into that. It's very, very different now. And I think we have to kind of appreciate that when we're looking at running technique. As we compare ourselves to the elites and compare ourselves to the top club runners, I think we're kind of disillusioning ourselves, but we're making it harder, a lot harder. But I'm glad you said those things, because that's exactly what I've been teaching ever since I've been coaching. Right back from the very, very beginning, probably, when did I really start coaching? 2015, I think, probably around about there was when I started to share my experience with other people. Relaxed upright posture. For me, high cycling heels. Driving from smooth, powerful, stable hips. Well, that's where the movement fluidity comes from. Running from the lower body, shaping from the upper body. Outside of that, everything else really is just is a nicety to have. It's a detail. It's something that can make you faster or slightly more economical. But these things, and this is Alvis, one of my girls, when she was, I want to say, 8 or 9 years old, doing a cross country, and she's displaying all her stuff. So she has got, relaxed upright posture. Well, we can see she's pretty relaxed. It's not really creating any tension. She's an open hand here. This one's maybe a little bit more tense, but really not much tension going on there. High cycling heels. So this, you can see this leg has clearly come up quite high and cycling round. This one's about to do the same. She has this amazing triple extension. So extended at the ankle, extended at the knee, extended at the hip. She also has a nice extension on the shoulder with a nice relaxed elbow. Okay, so this is a really, she was sprinting, sprint finish of this cross country at the time, but that's a really nice dynamic running posture that she's having. Okay, and you can clearly see that she's driving from down here, and she's not driving from her arms because they're nice and relaxed. Now, if you saw her from the front, it's a slightly different story, because she's only very slim then, very, very tiny. When she's running this fast, actually her hips are doing this, rotating really, really, really fast as she's going towards the finish line. But what that's displaying, although yes, she would definitely benefit from more hip stability in that rotational plane, her upper body stayed perfectly still. So it demonstrated that she was running from the lower body and just shaping it from the upper body. So that's exactly what you said, and that's kind of how I've always taught technique. This is the end goal. Okay, so kind of almost exactly what you said, because this is where they get that moving fluidity from. So if we look at the main elements of running technique, and I looked this up as well, just to see if what I was kind of teaching was what is still currently being taught by people. And I don't pay a lot of attention to some of this. I do, but it's a bit of an afterthought. But the common elements of running technique, if you look this up, is cadence and stride frequency. Okay. Posture, foot placement, and I added in rocker here. So this is foot rocker, which we'll talk a little bit about. But foot placement, foot rocker, ground contact time, so how long your feet are spending on the ground in each step, and vertical oscillation, how much you bounce up and down. Okay, so these are the elements of running technique. Now, what's really interesting, though, is these are the common elements of running technique, but then you go and do a search on what factors influence running technique. And you have things like strength and conditioning. Then you have cadence. Well, hang on a minute. We just said cadence is an element of running technique. Now it's influencing running technique. And then we have ground contact down here as well. And we've just said that's an element of running technique, but that's influencing running technique. So for me, I think people are getting really confused, because if you're going to say that cadence, which is an element of running technique, also influences running tech, you might as well say your haircut influences running technique. You know, or how long your shorts are influences running technique. And this is what I mean about the confusion about the information on the internet. But I will agree, posture and alignment, maybe not so much alignment. I'm going to want to just talk about that a little bit. Mobility and flexibility, again, not my terms. My terms would be movement fluidity. And the reason is you can have mobility around a joint. You can have flexibility in certain planes of motion, but you might not coordinate any of that together. So you can have these in isolation. That does not mean you have movement fluidity when you want to run. Okay, and that's super, super important. And this is why when I started to look at this, I went, yes, this is going to take a few live calls to get through all this, because there's quite a lot we have to understand from a base level first before we go into any of the kind of nuances of some of these things. Neuromuscular coordination, massively important, hugely, hugely important, and footwear and surfaces, which I would say, yes, of course, they influence as well. Posture is an interesting one, and we're going to go and have a look at that in a minute, a little bit more detail. But there are some omissions here, okay? Some other things that influence running technique: fatigue. Just what you said, Erica. When you get tired, you notice you bend over. I mean, that's a huge, probably the number one thing that influences running technique, yet it's a massive omission. And what was really interesting, and it just flashed up, I didn't have a chance to look at it, but it flashed up my Facebook feed this afternoon. I was probably Ron as well, because the normal ones that came up with these articles. I said, oh, we've been training legs to get through the wall of the marathon, but do you know what? It might not be that. It might be the core now. You think, yeah, okay, it might be the core. Do you know what it's more likely to be? It's the fact you're getting tired and your base systems can't help keep your running form together. Because next, 6 months time, they'll say, oh, well, yeah, the core's really important. The legs are really important. No, you know what it is now? It's just neck strength or something. It'll be something else. Okay. And because you'll see, it's because we're dealing at the wrong end of all of this. And speed influences your running technique as well. And that's because maybe your underlying systems can't cope with that effort output. So we have to recognize that running is an output. Okay, it's the baked cake at the end of the process. You've got to look at the ingredients, you've got to look at the process, and running technique is an output. And this is why things like saying cadence influences your running technique, you might as well, as I say how your hair is cut influences your running technique. Okay, because cadence is an element of running. It is an output itself, and yes, of course, it does influence your running technique, but that's a bit like chicken and egg. It's kind of not very helpful to say that, but we have to appreciate that running is an output. Okay, and that becomes really, really important when we start looking at these things. As when we look at every single element of running technique, every single one of these is an output. Okay, how fast you can turn your feet over is a direct output of movement fluidity and motor control. When you combine it with things like ground contact time in particular, and we'll talk about that in a minute. Posture, which we're going to focus a little bit more on today, okay? Foot placement and rocker, where you place your feet is reliant on lots of other things happening, okay? How long your feet spend on the ground are reliant on lots of other things happening. They're all outputs. How much you bounce up and down, and you've probably seen people running with a lot of bounce, you've probably seen people walking with a lot of bounce, and there are some underlying neurological reasons why that happens. So what I thought would be interesting to do today is to look at these things, but in relation to some of the most recent reviews, so scientific reviews or research reviews. Okay, the first one is running related biomechanical risk factors for overuse injuries in distance runners. Oh, that's the dog trying to get in. There we go. Systematic review. Considering injury specificity and the potentials for future research 2022. So recent one, the importance of running technique on running performance, much easier to say that one. And that was 2024. So two recent literature reviews really on this. Okay. What they say. So we're going to compare what the traditional view is about what these things say. So we're going to look at cadence, because this is the one that still comes up an awful lot in terms of cadence. And I don't do as many running assessments as I used to do, but I used to do an awful lot of them. And cadence was always the thing. Either people had very, very low cadence, or people had very high cadence. And what is very apparent is there a trend over the last 5 or 6 years, particularly, of people having a very high cadence, because we think that having a very high cadence is good for us. Okay, so. Lost it. So if we look at why cadence became such a big thing, So Jack Tupper Daniels, coach, he's often cited as, he passed away last year, he's often cited as the world's best coach. And he came up with this thing in a back in the 80s of 180 beats per minute is the optimal number for cadence. Okay, so that's where, if you hear this 180 beats per minute, that's where it came from. Okay, and he observed this in the 1984 Los Angeles Olympics. What he basically did is he looked at sprinters, and he looked at middle distance, and he looked at marathoners. He said, oh, they all have the same cadence. They all have the same turnover. Therefore, that must be what we have to do. That's the optimal number. Now, I don't know whether he was actually drinking Jack Daniels at the time, but if you look at any elite athlete now across those disciplines, none of them have the same cadence. And in fact, you'd be hard pushed to find anybody, maybe sprinters might do, but certainly at marathon level, there's going to be a wide range of cadences there. Okay. But this became law for a very long period of time. And when I started running, that was the goal. The goal was to get to 180 beats per minute. But then we grew up a little bit and we look into a little bit more detail, and it's actually flawed research because he only observed that. He didn't then go out and observe it anywhere else. He wrote it into his book, The Running Formula, Jack Daniels' Running Formula, and it became this massive thing globally that this is what you had to do. And so when you read it on the internet about cadence, this is largely where it comes from. But you'll find a wide range among elite athletes. And the latest research says that cadence is actually overstated. Okay, it's not as important as we used to think it is. But there are some instances where it is really helpful to you. So if you're coming back from injury and you want to have less loading, then one way to do that is to have a higher cadence so your feet are on the ground for less time. Okay, so there's less joint loading. But, and this is where I think people get really, really confused, is if you're running like this with a really fast cadence, that's no different than just your feet spending a little bit more time on the ground, okay? Because there's no heel lift. You're not lifting your feet up. You're just doing this. You've got a really fast cadence, but there's no air time. Those muscles are not getting any kind of relaxation or any kind of rest, even if it's a few milliseconds. They're getting nothing. So there's no improvement. Improved cadence with a higher heel lift, now that's a different story, because then your feet are pop, 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 less power down or up. But if you're doing this and you go out and you look at a lot of runners who are in the, and this is nothing against them or their pace or anything else, we're just purely talking technique here, okay? So it's not any form of criticism or anything. But if you look at slower runners who have a higher cadence, you'll notice, okay, that their feet barely come off the ground. But they're just doing it very, very fast. It's like a shuffle. We'll call that a shuffle gait or a scissor gait. And it did used to make me laugh. And in my workshops, I did used to have a slide that said that had a picture of someone whose feet were off the ground, who had that style of gait. The feet were off the ground and went, yay, flying feet. And that's because the photographer happened to have got them in a flying feet position. But actually, if he got them the rest of the time, there's like millimeters worth of clearance. So that is not the same thing. And I think people get really confused over that side of things. And so this is, again, where some of the information falls down. A higher cadence with a heel lift so that your feet are spending less time on the ground can be really beneficial at some times, okay? But there is no optimal number globally. Your cadence is your cadence. But there are still, I think, thresholds within people. So if you are trying to run a 5K or 10K or even up to half marathon, but your cadence is down at 160, and you don't have huge long legs, because obviously the longer your leg is, the quicker it's got to get back to have a higher cadence. So if you're of average height and you have a 160 cadence, that's probably, I would say, probably too low, because you are spending too much time on the ground, okay? Which we'll look at ground contact time. But if you've got long legs, it changes slightly, because you have to have that coordination to be able to get your legs back round quicker. Okay, used to be said that people with long legs were better runners, but actually, most of the elites are all short, and that's why, because they can get a higher cadence and power down. Okay, but we also have this thing called a power efficiency ratio. Okay, which we'll kind of not look at specifically, but we'll kind of look at when we look at go on a little bit. But the big question we have to ask is, what influences cadence? Okay, what things cause us to have a quicker cadence, or things that cause us to have our, you know, feet slightly a longer on the tire, slower cadence? Okay. So then posture. So the traditional perspective on posture is posture influences our force direction, okay, which is why we said we want a forward lean. Something else that's been hugely misinterpreted across the particularly the recreation running world is that we think of forward lean, this is a forward lean. But actually it's a lean from the ankles and it's only 7 degrees. It's almost imperceptible. Okay, so when we talk about forward lean, I use it with my youth athletes, and I do use it if I'm teaching people, but I use it as a way to start off doing some other good drills and training. I would much rather someone stood up nice and relaxed and up and tall than try and create a forward lean, because forward lean for most people means they're collapsing from the waist. Okay, and that's just not, that then can lead to other things. So traditional perspective as well is that posture influences running economy. Okay, so if you're overstriding, so if your posture is forwards, then you overstride. I've observed that. I think that's absolutely true. You can have a hip drop, and you can get lower back pain because you're putting those muscles under stretch tension, and you're probably, your pelvis is not really locked in properly, so you're asking your lower back to a bit more stability than maybe it's used to doing. And posture influences joint loading. So your angles change, loads shift. That can have a tissue impact as well as a performance impact, you know, and it can impact your breathing mechanics. So as you're collapsing forward, you're limiting your rib expansion, you're limiting your diaphragm movement, and therefore your lung capacity. And then your injury risk increases because all of these things are above, okay? So I'm not going to say anything about this is wrong, but what I am going to say is, because all of this is true, when you lean forwards particularly, a lot of these things do happen. However, I look at this in a different way than maybe traditionally we would look at. Because a traditional perspective is that posture is a controllable input that determines mechanical output. Okay, so you fix your posture, that'll improve your mechanics, which will improve your performance and reduce your injury risk. Okay, so that's working on the basis that we can improve our posture. So we then look at, okay, so how do we improve our posture? So we look at posture devices, we look at standing tall, we do all the strength work, we do all of these bits and pieces, and lo and behold, we still collapse when we're at mile 20 of a marathon. Okay, or if we're putting a lot of effort in 8K into a 10K. Okay. My perspective is very different. Posture is an output. Okay, it's the end of the line. And the fact that it collapses and then has a domino effect is a consequence of that output not being managed properly, okay? So posture is a visible expression of how safe and organized your nervous system feels under load, okay? It's a strategy. Because when your load increases, so speed, fatigue, terrain, stress, etc., when all that increases, your brain starts asking questions of the system. Where am I in space? Vestibular, visual, proprioceptive, integration. How stable do I feel? Okay. Which comes down to movement fluidity. How much tension or relaxation are you creating? Vestibular integration, visual integration. How much energy do I have? Fueling, hydration, breathing is a brain fuel. So oxygen is a brain fuel along with carbohydrate. And how threatened do I feel? And threatened, when we're talking about in this sense, is does the brain feel safe to be able to make a prediction? Because remember, it's predicting a moment ahead of where we are. It's always making a prediction. So can it predict safely? And your posture will change based on those answers. So it's a reflection of all these inputs and the system processing. That's what creates a posture. And then the posture will have an impact on all those other things. Okay, but you can't change posture by dealing with it as an input, because it's not, it's an output. Okay. So then we have to ask the question, what influences posture? So foot placement and foot rocker. Okay, so this is one of the things that I've always taught. I always thought it's very, very important. So the traditional perspective is that heel striking is bad for you. Forefoot or midfoot is best. And that's kind of still very, very prevalent, although thankfully it is changing, depends where you read about this kind of stuff. But normally we say heel striking is bad, forefoot or midfoot is best, okay? But if we are running and we're landing out ahead of us, we're overstriding because our posture is poor or just because we don't know any better, okay? And we land on our heel, there's a breaking, we're breaking, okay? We're breaking and then we come down and over it because it's a lot further for us to go over when we land. So we land midfoot overstriding. So now we're landing like this overstriding. So we're putting pressure here on this part and we're overstriding. So now we've moved the forces more towards our shins and stretching our calf. So the calves can't have quite as much, we're still a bit of contraction in the calves actually, but it's harder to stabilize, okay? Or if we're forefoot striking, but we're overstriding, we're now landing on the smallest part of the foot, the least balance point, so least width, so the hardest point to balance on. We're now putting our shins under massive stress, and we're putting our calves under stress, our ankles under stress, and we're asking the system to do an awful lot more work. So is heel striking bad? Well, I think if you're overstriding, heel striking is probably the best thing you can do. But actually what we want to do is get rid of that altogether. We want to say, okay, it's not about whether you're heel striking, whether you're forefoot striking, whether you're midfoot striking. It's about where you put your foot, okay? Where your foot lands in relation to your body is key. Because if you are landing, you don't want landing underneath your body, or that can be good training if you're doing uphill work or downhill work even maybe, both perhaps, but certainly downhill work, okay? Landing underneath your body as well, okay? If you land on your heel here and your body is here, okay, you naturally go across. Okay, you're using your foot rocker. Okay, so this is the reason why I'm using this shoe. This is a Skechers shoe from 2019, and it has more of a rocker in it. So as you land on your heel, you naturally rocker across. They call it M strike, and the Skechers performance shoes still have M strike on them, the newer ones. And the Hockers, when they brought out their first line of shoes, were all for endurance runners, for ultra runners, and they had bigger stack height. But they had a big foot rocker on them. And that was what it was, because when you get tired and you land here, you use your foot rocker. So when we walk in a heel-to-toe manner. When we're running, we do exactly the same. Just because we're landing closer to our center of mass, we actually miss the heel out. Or we're kind of landing. So I still feel I'm landing midfoot, because that's the prominent part I want to land on. But actually, I'm still coming down like this. And we'll talk about the nuances of this type of technique in another live call when we get into the detail of each particular part. But landing here underneath you, or landing here, or landing here, I still recommend landing. Is Julia coming back in? I still wouldn't recommend landing way ahead of right forefoot, because you still put lots of stuff under stress. But at least I always say, midfoot or whole foot is best, okay? But certainly landing where you put your foot is more important than whether it's heel, midfoot, or forefoot, okay? And that's a really, really important thing. And I've always taught that since day one, because it just helps to from running an economy perspective, it's better so you're not breaking as much. Because what it also encourages you to do when you combine it with things like a high heel lift is your foot is coming round and it's already coming back at the time. Okay, that's key. It's already coming back. Okay, if you're overstriding, what you're doing is you're putting your foot out in front of you like this, and then you're wanting to go over it. So you're jarring it with every single stride. People land with their legs, you know, straight as they hit the ground. We want it to be coming back on us. But we'll look at that in much more detail in a future one. So using that foot and ankle rocker is really important. Okay, that's a shock absorb mechanism. It's a propulsion mechanism. It comes free with birth for most of us when we're born with our feet and ankles, but we just don't use it very well. And I have people who come in who have got incredible ankle range of movement, but they just don't use it at all. Now, interestingly, carbon fiber shoes are designed to take that out because they take over from doing that. They're designed to stiffen up the ankles. Why you don't train in carbon shoes? Racing carbon shoes, brilliant. They can be good for some of your long runs every now and again because they help with recovery, but they change fundamentally your biomechanics and they change how your foot and ankle feet and ankle work. So we don't really want to be using carbon shoes a lot in training, particularly. So then we have to, ask the question, what influence is foot placement and foot and ankle rocker? Okay. Ground contact time. So traditional perspective is that a shorter time on the ground is more economical. And the updated perspective is it agrees at certain speeds, okay, faster speeds. So the less time you spend on the ground, the less joint loading, but at faster speeds. Because if you're going to try and have a short amount of ground contact time at slower speeds, you have to do a lot more muscular. You either have to have really good stiff spring, which is something I try and train a lot of, but you have to get that pop at a slow speed is quite hard to do, and you end up using, it's not very efficient. Use a lot of energy to be able to do that. But that was always my goal with people, is to get them to be able to do that at a slower speed, because then you know you've mastered it. So a shorter ground contact time is more economical because it's less friction, less loading on the joints. It's a good thing to do. But just having short ground contact time and high cadence, what's really interesting about those two things is they can coexist, and they shouldn't be able to coexist. Really, if you've got high cadence, you should have a short ground contact time. But if you've got a very low heel lift, you can have both. And that's kind of the worst of both worlds, really. So then you have to ask the question again, what influences ground contact time? Vertical oscillation. So this is how much you move up and down. Traditional perspective, the lower vertical time, less bouncing is more economical. And those research reviews agree fully with that. Lower vertical time is more economical. Okay, so we have to ask the question then, what influences vertical oscillation, so that we can then address that. So we look at the core findings of these two literature reviews is running technique is highly individual. There is no ideal running technique. Okay, X, Y, Z angle for, you know, all runners doesn't apply. 180 beats per minute does not apply. When you look on the internet and they say you have to do this to run fast, run a faster 5K by doing this running technique, might not apply to you. Okay, so understanding the basis of it helps you to tailor your technique to yourself. Okay, we are constrained by our anatomy, our strength, our tendon stiffness, and our training history. Okay, so our running technique, if you have something fundamentally wrong with your hips or your back, you may not be able to stand up straight. Okay, and that's perfectly okay. You will compensate for it. Strength, we know we need a certain amount of capacity, and we know we need to be able to access that capacity. Okay, we know that strength is really important, but we know that accessing that strength is absolutely vital for sanity and managing our time very well, but also from a performance perspective and a lower injury risk perspective as well. Tendon stiffness, really, really important. If you have stiff, stiff, not tense, two different things. If you have a nice stiff spring, then you can have that pop much more easily. And training history is a really interesting one. So when I qualified as a coach, through all that, they talk about two different ages, your biological age or your chronological age. That's how old we are in years since birth. And then we have a training age. And a training age, or more specifically, a running age. How long have you been running for? And that's not the same as if you've been playing football for 10 years and you transition into running. Your running age is still nothing. Okay, some of it is a carryover, but a lot of it isn't, a carryover. And that's what some of that last podcast was actually talking about, how much actually carries over to your training from what you do. And in my day, when I first started running, no one in their right mind would start running and then 6 months later go and run a marathon. That's common these days. People do a couch to 5K and the next week they're doing a marathon. Toughest trail marathon they could possibly find along the Jurassic Coast, and then they wonder why they get injured, and they wonder why they keep on getting injured, because they keep on doing these things. And this is the whole thing about it's okay to walk, because I won't have that running maturity, I won't do the training, I'll just go out and do this really, 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 really difficult event, and it's okay because I can walk through it, because nowadays all the cutoff times have been extended by 2 or 3 hours to facilitate for that. And again, there's nothing wrong with that if that's what you go out and intend to do. But then you can't pretend to yourself that there isn't going to be some kind of repercussion of that. You just didn't do it. I think I'd been running for 2 or 3 years before I did a marathon the first time. And I'd kind of built up to that, because you need to have tissue integrity. You need to have, you know, the whole neuromuscular adaptations that go along with it. You need to have psychological adaptations that go along with it as well. It's not about being fast or anything else, but it's about adapting to that. You know, it's like going down to the gym. It's about joining a gym, doing the initial session with the coach, and they say, yeah, you're okay to come in, and coming in and trying to lift something that's three times as heavy as you can actually lift. That's exactly what that is. No one would do that in their right mind, but we do it in running. And I just, it's always baffled me. But then, you know, that's the big shift that's happened over the last probably 12 or 13 years. I used to say it in my workshops, but I made myself a little bit unpopular, so I stopped saying it about that, because that's what people do. And because everyone else is doing it, and I get it, I understand it, but I just still think it's not right anyway. And the other thing they found was that your technique is adapted to the speed and fatigue. The two major influences that are missed off that, what influences running technique. Yeah, probably the two biggest things that influence your technique. Okay, so in terms of running economy, they found that better running economy is associated with a lower vertical oscillation, because you're wasting less energy going up and down, shorter ground contact time at faster speeds, greater leg stiffness, that stiff spring, because you can get that pop, 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 elastic energy return, which is kind of related to the same thing. Okay, so you get elastic energy return, you're using less, you're not having to lift your heels up when you run, because it all happens naturally. And that comes down to how you land on your feet, how you use your foot rocker, all that kind of stuff. Okay. An appropriate stride frequency for you and your distance. So when I was doing 5Ks and 10Ks, probably up to about half marathon, I was probably 176 to 185 cadence when I was racing, probably close to the 185 for a lot of the shorter stuff. But then when I transitioned over to marathons, that dropped right down to 170 to 176, because it's a different thing. We have this power efficiency ratio, okay? So what if you're a sprinter, you don't care how much energy you use, because you're only going to last 10 seconds if you're doing 100 meters. Okay. So your power is up here and your efficiency is down here. So even though you've got a high cadence, you want to put as much power down into that, into every single stride as you possibly can do. Now, as you start to move up the distances, that ratio changes. So at middle distance is probably, and I coach a junior middle distance group, they're aged 11 to 13. And I always say to them that this is the hardest thing you can do is middle distance, because you need to have as much power down as you can get, but as much endurance as you can get. So you need to be here somewhere. And that's really, really difficult. So as we go through the distances, you know, we do this. So now efficiency is more important than power. We still need to have the power if you want to run fast, if you want to run well and enjoy it, make it feel easy and fluid. But we need to have economy so that you can carry on doing it for a long time. Forget ultras for a minute, because it's a whole different way of running. But up to the marathon, and this is why it kind of frustrates me a little bit when people talk about walking the marathon, they compare it to ultras. It's a different thing. When you go over 50K, everything changes with that. It's a completely different scenario. So we have this power efficiency ratio. Okay. And we've always got to be, as a coach, when I'm coaching people, this is what we've got to think about a little bit here. So this stride frequency has got to take that into account as well. Okay, so when we look at quickening up your stride, are we allowing you to put enough power down, or are you better off having a slightly slower cadence, a nicer heel lift, but being able to put down a little bit more power? Okay, and these are the things you kind of have to offset a little bit. So that's all good and well, but where do you start? So where do you start with all of this? Cutting through all that kind of internet information, all the books, all the stuff that's there that you could kind of get lost in, and probably have got lost in, as I have done for many years. First of all, you have to recognize that running technique is an output. Okay. I think you guys all know that movement is an output. So that's probably a given within this environment. So that's good. And then you influence your running technique through the inputs, the integration, and the processing. Okay. And that fundamentally is, once you understand that, then everything becomes a lot easier to understand where you're going. So then you identify what influences the elements, that element of technique that you want to train. So we're going to start with probably the most popular one in a minute. And then you follow the neuroactive method. And this is taking me, I mean, it's so simple, the method, but it's taken me over 5 years to develop it. Identify, clean, train, strengthen. Identify, clean, train, integrate, strengthen, I should really say. Okay, so no matter what that element is, you're going to identify the lowest signal. You're going to clean that signal up. You're going to train that system. You're going to integrate it with the other system. And then you're going to strengthen those changes. Okay, and you can do that for each of those elements of running technique. And if you, and then that'll help you achieve that global fluidity and that nice sort of relaxed style. Well, the thing was really interesting to me on that Portland Coastal Marathon is that I slowed down before my technique fell apart. So my technique doesn't tend to fall apart. Sometimes there's a bit of hip collapse here and there, but my technique doesn't fall apart. I just slow down. Whereas other people try and fight and fight and fight through it, and their technique starts all collapsing and everything else. And then when that happens, it's hard to come back from that. So not only is your technique collapsed, but then your pace is collapsed along with it. And then it plays on with the interoceptor stuff. Oh, I can't do this. I have to trudge through and all the rest of it. And yeah. And you know, we've all been there. But by maintaining a good running technique, or at least feeling like you're able to do that, even if you're slowing down, you still feel strong. It can be frustrating because you're slowing down, but you know you're strong, so that's okay. So I want to start with posture, okay? Because I think posture is probably, I think posture is probably the number one for most people. For me, it's the number one, because I think if you are got a nice, fluid, dynamic posture, lots of these other things fall into place naturally, okay? Your feet will land closer to your center of mass. Okay, you're naturally putting yourself in a good position to be able to train a higher heel lift. Okay, these things will be much easier to do. So, what influences posture? Your visual system, your vestibular system, and your proprioceptive system. No surprise to you guys there, really. And of course, the integration between those systems. So when you look at your visual system, can you see your environment around you when you're running? Do you need to have contact lenses in? And, you know, some people probably can run a little bit blurry, but I think in most cases, seeing the environment around you is really, really important, because that normally in most contexts, and it's not always the case, but in most contexts, 70% of our decision making is based on our visual system. Okay, that's where we put most of the weighting. So if you've not got good information coming from your visual system, and you've only got partial information, that makes it unreliable. Okay, partial maps, it's unsafe to predict. And if it's unsafe to predict, you have to simplify your movement, and you have a higher reliance on your vestibular and your proprioceptor systems. Okay, and we can split that visual system into two, or it's into multiple parts. First of all, you've got acuity. How clearly can you see around you? Okay, this is acuity vision. Are things blurred? Because if you've got blurred vision and you're trying to run fast, you can't see things that are coming towards you. That's not a safe environment for you to be in. And your brain knows that. Okay. Now, some people can go through that blindly, I was going to say, but some people can go through that and seemingly not care. But is that really true underneath? I don't know. I would suspect that there is normally for most people a threat level there. But we also have this eye movements, this tracking. Okay, can you smoothly track, smooth pursuits is why we do these exercises. Can we smoothly track targets as we're running? Okay, and that's super important if you're running a race and there's lots of people around you, or if you're running the forest and you've got trees going past. And I have had people, I have one person in who felt sick when they're running through a forest because they couldn't process all the stuff coming towards them. Okay, so that depth perception for them was terrible. And that tracking side of things. So can you locate things properly? Okay, so that's kind of saccades as well. Can you move your eyes back and forward without having to move your whole body? Depth perception. Again, can you have a good idea of where things are in relation to where you are? Okay, and then we've also got your peripheral vision or ambient vision here as well. Okay, everything going past you. That person who was getting sick with stuff coming towards them, that was also happening, things going past them. So I had to do training specifically for stuff going past them. Okay, and that was slowing them down and making them feel sick. So you can see that vision is incredibly important to posture, because that'll affect if your brain doesn't know where you are. Okay, that first question, where am I in 3D space? Where am I in my environment? If it doesn't know that, if it can't detect that, that will affect your posture. So if you look then at your vestibular system, can you sense your environment? Okay, do you know where your vertical center is, your visual vertical, your vestibular vertical? Where is it? And if it isn't, if it's slightly off, that will affect your posture. If your brain thinks your vertical is over here, your posture will be over here. Okay, and Mark, that's what his was for quite a while. That's why he got one of his injuries was some groin pain on one side, and that was because he was loading it too much, because his vertical center was over here. So I had to retrain him, do some rotating dots and some other bits and pieces for to bring his vertical center back. Is your horizontal center in the right place? If it's not, that will affect that forward flexion. And you may get away with it in normal life because you create a lot of tension to be able to hold it, but when you're tired, you can't do that anymore. Okay, so that goes. So sensing your environment is really, really important. Okay, and we have different apparatus to help us do that. Because again, partial information, unreliable information, unsafe to predict, higher reliance on your vision and your proprioceptor systems. And in terms of your vestibular system, we have our ear canals. Okay, so we have the ear canals where they detect head movement this way and this way. Gravity independent, doesn't matter about gravity. You can do this sitting down. You do this lying down, and it's the same. Doesn't matter. It's gravity independence, about where your head is in relation to the rest of you. Okay. But if those ear canals are not functioning properly, if the messages that are coming back in to your brain are not meeting what your visual system is saying, that can cause problems. The same as your otolith organs. So you have two sets of otolith organs. You have one set that does linear acceleration, deceleration, okay, forward and back in this, what's called the sagittal plane. And we also have it in lateral movement called the frontal plane. So that's what those that they detect. And then we have an up and down. OK, so we have a vertical one as well. So we can see with vertical oscillation, if you have these otolith organs aren't working as well as it could do, then you're probably trying to get a lot more bounce to stimulate them. And that's where this up and down comes in. OK, so that can really affect that posture and affect that running technique as well. And these things have got to really tightly integrate with your visual system. And when you have mismatches, that's where you get motion sickness from. If what you're seeing doesn't match what you're sensing, it can make you feel sick and your brain wants you to get you out of that situation, okay? And that's to a mismatch. Any mismatch across these systems can cause problems and it affects your posture. Now, the other thing I want to say about posture is flexion is our natural threat response. So if someone throws something at you, we're going to flex to protect ourselves. So whenever you feel under threat, you're going to flex in. So our natural thing is to not have extension, which is what we need for nice posture. We need to have a balance of flexion and extension. And if we've got too much flexion, then we bend forwards. And if you've got too much flexion naturally, but you're trying to hold it up by doing lots of core work and lots of tension work, you're kind of kidding yourself on, because as soon as you're tired and your system can't do that, bang, straight away, you're not able to maintain that. Okay. So we have to, and this is why I really talk about capacity versus expression, because you can make yourself really strong when you're in very low load environments. But as soon as that load goes up, you can't maintain it. And then the true picture comes out. So that's why we train at a base level. And then we have our proprioceptor system. Can you sense your environment from your joints, your muscles and your skin? Okay. Can you determine and say running from your feet, from your ankles, knees, hips, can all of these sensors in all of these areas help map to your brain where you are in 3D space? And remember, we are predicting what we're doing a moment ahead. So you take a step and there's a prediction about how that step is going to land and the outcome of all of that. So that's already ahead of time as you go to do it. Then as you land, you have to adjust to that. And that adjustment is adjusting the predictive model for the next step. That's already too late for that step. So if you've got poor muscular coordination, then the prediction for the next step might be okay in terms of coordination. But if the terrain changes, you're out. This is why mapping is so important. It's why I get, when I'd used to do a lot of this type of training, specifically in these environments, I would get people to do lots of position, foot position specific stuff, squats, feet ahead, feet in, feet out, one foot in, one foot out, and all these different ways to replicate when you're landing, particularly on trail or off the edge of a curb, how is your brain going to react to it? Because it has a model, does it much quicker. If it doesn't have a model, it's got to try and, it's got to sift through and find an appropriate model to use to be able to do it. And then it applies it to the next step ahead of you. Okay, so it's quite a complex system. And if we don't have all this information coming in, again, it's unreliable, unsafe to predict, simplify movement. So whenever something's unsafe, the movement will simplify. And then we have a higher reliance on the other two systems. Now, interesting, I just had somebody who is currently out injured, and I did an assessment quite a long time ago with them. And it turns out that they are very, very poor at doing slow coordinated movement. Okay, so doing things like doing a shoulder circle slowly was so challenging. They couldn't, it was all judgery, there was no accuracy. So their natural tendency is to do everything fast. But they're out injured and they've had this recurring injury for quite a long time, over quite a few years, a couple of years at least. And it's always been diagnosed as something horrendous. And actually, when it comes down to it, it never is that horrendous. But that's what they've always been told. But it was just something that somebody said to me the other day. And I thought, do you know what? That's really interesting. Because they have unfinished business with a marathon, because they should have done a marathon at a much faster time. At a time a few years ago when I was coaching them. But they went out a little bit too fast and it ended up being a bit of a disaster. Now, they've always tried to do marathon training again since then. But what they've always done is they've done most of that marathon training with people who are naturally slower than they are. So this person can go out and run 4:30-minute kilometer pace for a 10K. Okay. But when they're doing their marathon training is somewhere between 5, 15 and 6 plus minutes per kilometer pace. So they're asking their body, their systems, to coordinate their joints at a very slow pace. And that's exactly their highest injury risk area, because they can't do it. So they would be better off ditching all the people that they train with and actually just doing their own thing at a much higher pace, much faster pace, because that naturally for them, they could coordinate better at that. I mean, ultimately, obviously, they're better training at the slower one, so they could run at anything. But for them, that's their highest injury area. And it was interesting when I looked through their cycle, it's repetitive. Over the last 3 years, same thing, time and time again. And that's because they're in that environment. And this is why, you know, when we do the assessments here, we do all the cerebellar assessments, that tells me that sort of thing. Okay. And that was just really interesting about that. And we have all these, we have lots of receptors coming in. So we have joint receptors, they're called mechanoreceptors. Mechanoreceptors around all the joints. We have a high density. Have a high density of joints. So your feet, your hands, that's why they're such a big input area to your brain. And they give joint position, they give location, they give range of movement, speed of movement, and obviously brain-body mapping. So when you roll an ankle, for example, if you don't rehab that properly, then your brain doesn't know where that end range is. It's got a poor map, and it can't determine speed, you know, acceleration of that movement. Okay, so mapping has become really, really important. And we also have those on the skin stretch, as one I've said before, it's just I found so, so important for people, particularly with knee pain and other pains, that skin stretch is just super, super important. But we have these receptors within muscles, Golgi tendon organs, for example, that detect stretch and all this kind of stuff as well. Okay, so really, really important. So these three systems are super, super important. And these three things are what influence posture. Okay. So coming back to the traditional view, things that do not work in the mid to long term and almost never under fatigue load and pressure are things like stand up tall. Okay. And now you can understand why they don't work, because if you can't fundamentally do it, you can't do it. Okay. And I will go through them. So things like traditional strength exercises for exactly the same reason. Okay, you've got to balance. You can hold a certain amount of tension for a certain amount of time, but as soon as you get under fatigue, as soon as you get under pressure, the tension goes and you can no longer hold it up, because you don't have the base skill of that extension and flexion balance. Postural devices, again, mid to long term, they just don't work. Okay, I'm going to put a caveat in here, which is unless you're just being lazy, because some people are just lazy. They're able to do it, they just don't do it. I use stand up tall. I use over the hedge, helium balloon, as cues, particularly for my youth athletes. But I tend to do it after I've done some other basic work with them, and then I do this to, as a strengthening for them. Okay, so they can get into that position. I use it with myself when I'm running. I think about tall, but I know that's because I have the base skill to be able to do that when I'm tired. Postural devices, they might work in the moment. And yes, there might be some residual effect from that. But you'd probably have to use it for an awful long time. And you'd have to be very deliberate about actually using it to create some of that strengthening, for example, within that, and doing some vestibular training whilst you're in there. Then this becomes a really useful tool. But by themselves, they'll hold you in that position when you're using it. As soon as you take it off, you know, that effect is gone, basically. Because we really need to clear out the systems first. So clear out the deficits, then your posture will naturally improve. And then if you need to, you can train it further. Okay. So the reason why I can maintain my posture when I'm running, when I get tired, my pace slow down, yes, which is frustrating, but it's because I have this, I'm always trying to look at the system deficit side of things. Okay, what is it that's stopping my posture from being nice and tall when I'm tired? Okay. And that's not to say I have perfect form, because I don't. And I don't think there is no such thing as perfect form, but even for me, I don't feel I do. Because it's an ongoing thing. That's the other thing about not being too self-critical when we see ourselves in pictures and that, because A, you don't know in that moment that somebody caught a photograph what that was actually like, how much load you're under. You know, there's so many factors why you might look in a crumpled heap when you see a photograph of yourself. So it's not necessarily, it's about consistency and about using these benchmarks going forward. So if every single photograph is like that and every single, then yeah, okay, we've got some work to do. Okay, so in summary, running technique is an output. Clear up the system deficits first. Assess and train for capacity if needed, because we have to recognize that capacity is important. And I am doing a whole podcast just on capacity, because I do bash capacity quite a lot, because I think people overtrain without training the access for it. And capacity, as far as I'm concerned, are the ABCs of running. Agility, balance, coordination, get the basics right first. I add two onto that I've developed over my years of doing this, which is accuracy and stability, both reflexive and conscious. Reflexive stability is what we really need when running, because that's the unconscious part of it. And then we have the individual skills for each of those elements. So once we have nice, tall, relaxed, natural posture, we're not forcing it, it's naturally there. We can then work on, okay, how do we get these high heels? Much easier to do then. Oh, the high heels, oh, foot placement. Gosh, magically, it kind of happens. And then we just train a bit of foot rocker. Easy. Rather than forcing each one of those elements. But then we have to assess and train the access to that capacity when we're under load and fatigue conditions. It's all right doing a bunch of running drills when you're fresh, but you have to do them when you're fatigued as well. Okay, you have to train yourself when you're tired. Okay, so doing some postural stuff at the end of a run, a long tiring, when you really don't want to do it, it's probably the best time to do it. Okay, doing some visual work, doing some vestibular work, and then putting yourself into that posture and holding it and then strengthening it in that position. That's what you want to do. Okay, so do we have any questions on that? Sorry, I kind of ranted on a little bit there. Any questions? Nope. Okay, so I'm going to move on to Mark's question, which is, are there any techniques that can be used during a run to improve or maintain body form when your body is under fatigue during the latter stages of a race or long run? Okay, so Mark, I'm going to come to you. After hearing all of that tonight, do you have any comments on that?
Not necessarily from tonight, but I did listen to your latest podcast today, and it kind of like made more sense to me that the brain endurance training is going to be a key of how that's going to develop. I may not be able to necessarily improve it during a run, but actually doing some more mapping and actually doing some brain endurance training would certainly help.
Definitely, exactly right. And I do have an answer for you, which is yes, but there are some cues that you can use. There are some things that you can do actually, but they do work best when you already have a system that's working well. Okay, I'll go over what they are. And it's basically what's called neural drive. And I a lot when I was learning this stuff, use these a lot when I was running. I use it slightly less now, more so when I remember. But they do help. Part of this is working through, for example, posture. What is this? So our posture is collapsing, because that's probably one of the most common ones. And if we get our posture right, then a lot of other things fall into place. And it makes us feel better that we're up nice and tall. So there are a couple of areas of the brain that are responsible for extension. So this is extension, flexion. Okay, so in extension, so our cerebellum is heavily involved in extension, and the other part of the brain is called the pons. Okay, it's part of the brainstem. But the cerebellum is a runner's best friend, because it's also very heavily involved in motor control, in accuracy, in timing. Okay, so it's a really, really important part of the brain for anyone who does a lot of movement, particularly when we've got complex joint coordination going on. Okay, cerebellum is really, really important. And cerebellum is involved in helping to manage extensor tone throughout the body. Okay, so as you start to flex forwards, you're losing extensor tone, you're gaining more flexor tone. So if we can stimulate the cerebellum, we can then facilitate more extension. Okay, and we're gonna try this, if you like. So one of the things we can do is piano fingers. So piano fingers is this one here. Okay. And you can go down with the index finger, up with the index finger, down with the pinky finger, up with the pinky finger. You can go down with that, and then up with that one, down with that one, up. So when you're running, what I tend to do when I'm running is I tend to do it into a figure of eight with my wrist, a wrist figure of eight. So can I try and do it in the rhythm, or try and match it with the rhythm we're running? That's a lot of cerebellar stimulation, particularly for thinking about it. Sometimes I'll do like 1, 3, 4, 2, and try and count and then miss and count and do this. That's also cerebellum training. Okay, so accuracy, it's timing. These are the things that cerebellum likes. Okay, that will give us more extension. Okay, so we can do some of that, and then we can see if we can stand up a little bit taller. Okay, we can do what's called a vertical VOR. AVOR. AVOR is angular visual ocular reflex. Okay, just vertical AOR, AVOR. So that would be vertical. So I would go from the midline, and I would keep my eyes fixed on a point, and I would do this with my head. Okay, now that's visual vestibular stimulation of that canal, but we're also doing a bit of midline stability as well. So as you're running, you can just do a little bit of that. What I tend to do is a little bit of this as well. I might do a little bit of that. I know about that. And yes, everyone thinks you're nuts, but you know what? You can then go, oh, I can stand a bit taller. Okay, so that's another thing we can do. Wide saccades. So pick two points. I pick maybe two trees a little bit ahead of me as I'm walking and I'm running. And saccade is where you jump your eyes from one target to next target to another target to next target, another target and to next target. Okay, your cerebellum is hugely involved, as is your vestibular system, in with that. So we're now following that neuroactive method of identify that we need more extension. Okay, so we clean that signal up by starting to do some training in it. So we're stacking some of these things together. We're integrating it by doing vestibular and visual work. Okay, wide saccades, and then of course, as the targets are getting closer to you, it's getting wider. Okay, so you might start off by just doing, you know, you're kind of doing this, and then it's eventually doing this, keeping your head still. Okay, so that's stimulating all of that. See if we can get some more extension. Okay, and then when you've got that extension, then we want to strengthen those changes. Okay, and this all can happen obviously very quickly when you're running. Strengthen changes, you can now go lead with the head, helium balloon, stand up tall, because now you're standing up tall and doing it. And then you maybe create a little bit of tension in your back and relax, Or what you can do is, as you're running, try and get a little bit more hip extension behind you, because that's extension, and tense your glutes a little bit, activate your glutes. That's also strengthening cerebellum and this extension. So that can help you bring that posture up a little bit. So that can just realign you. And that's probably the best way of using that word, realign, so that you can then carry on with the rest of your running form. It'll help you feel upright. Another thing you can do is use your eyes as a really good drill. And we're going to use our eyes in a second if you wanted to do it, is obviously we'll do a different version when running, but you follow it up, snap your eyes down, follow it up, snap your eyes down. So what we're doing is midline stability. Okay, so we're training our visual system and our vestibular system for midline stability. And that'll also help your brain feel safer on a single leg, which means it will feel less threatened, less flexion, flexor tone. Okay, so if you want, you can try this. It's easy to do if you're standing up, or you can do it if you've got if you're able to do a back extension. So you do a back extension like this, and just see how far you can go, or you can extend your your shoulder behind you. They're quite easy ones to do. Okay, and then flick your eyes up 3 times, and third one, see if you increase your extension. Okay, give it a go and see if it helps you. Erica's shy. Erica's not good.
Yeah, did me.
So you can use that when you're running. Obviously, anything where we're moving our eyes, just be a bit careful when you're running. But you could do that. You could do 1, 2, 3, stand up tall, reset on the horizon again. In that position, do a little bit of, just a little bit of strengthening work. You're doing a little bit more shoulder extension as you're running with your arms. That will also stimulate it as well. Okay, so these are just little things that you can do when you're running that'll help you to get some more posture. Once you've got that posture, you'll feel better, and then you can, some of the other things will click into place. Is that helpful?
Yes, it is. Thank you.
Cool. So these are kind of little primers that we can use, which I am writing a whole thing on primers a little bit, because I think they're fascinating that we can use. But I use eyes a lot. I use head movements a lot when I'm running, and I use this a lot. Because cerebellum, if you can stimulate your cerebellum when running, we can get better extension, so better hip extension as well as just upright extension, but better motor control. Okay, so that combats a little bit some of that fatigue, especially when you can combine it with some of the brain endurance training stuff.
It's quite funny that you mentioned about piano fingers. So when I do my training runs, or when I run with Gary and I get quite tense and I start collapsing, he says to me, piano fingers, to try and get me to just relax my upper body. But that's the reason that he's saying for me to do it, to just relax a bit. And I'm going to say to him now, it's to do with your cerebellum. Like, it's just made me smile that's something he says to me a lot. But now I can see how it would actually help, you know, what he's actually doing. Not just chilling me out, but, you know.
Not just chilling you out, which obviously is a benefit as well, because particularly you create an awful lot of tension, and you can see that in all the assessments.
Yeah.
And being able to allow that to relax a little bit probably does help you a lot as well.
Yeah.
That's cool. Good. Okay. Any questions on anything we've talked about or anything else?
I had a question about what you were saying earlier on. It was to do with where you are, and you talked about the visual and the peripheral and all those things, but you spoke about ear canals and the otolith organs.
Yes.
So in terms of like thing, particularly I'm thinking ear canals, I can see how you could improve like your peripheral vision by doing exercises and things, but how could you improve if you had an issue with your ear canals, which I do have? That's something that I was born with. So is that not, that isn't anything that I could necessarily train to improve?
I suppose that depends on what the issue is.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've got an itchy bone in one of my ears, so that impairs my hearing, but also, so it blocks that on the one side.
Okay, so is that the fluid-filled ear canals in terms of vestibular system, or is that auditory? Because they're not
auditory, I think, but I don't know a lot about it. I just know that there was a lot of stuff done when I was a kid. My ear is in some textbook somewhere, but I don't have any other information apart from the fact that it impairs my hearing on that side.
Okay, so it would be interesting to find out a little bit more about that. Because to stimulate the ear canals, you do things like the AVORs. So that a lot of that type of training stimulates ear canals. So there might be a certain direction that's worse than others that we would want to train more. So there might be a certain angle that's more threatening than others for you. So we'd maybe need to look at can we do some training on that? Can we force systems to work a little bit closer together? Might not be able to solve the problem, but can we clear up the maps a little bit better? Can we do some other auditory training? So positional auditory training that helps map your environment out a little bit, so that when your ear does get blocked and you lose the hearing, more of the hearing in that, you've still got a sense of where some location is. That can help map it out as well. So it's a lot about mapping out the environment around you, so that when your systems are at their lowest, you've still got the best chance you can of having a map there, as opposed to just accepting that, okay, you know, you've not got a map on that side.
Okay.
So there are things we can do with that, definitely.
Okay. Because obviously it's a physical block that we'll never be able to change unless I had surgery. But you know, my auditory nerve works because I can use bone conducting head bones, but there's something impairing that on that side.
Well, the ear canals themselves are they're fluid filled. I've got it on here. I don't know if I've got this. Is any battery on this? Oh, just about. Now, do I have where, if I can find him? Find this one. Oh, yeah, here we go. Oh, I don't know if you can. Can you see that?
Yeah.
So they're the ear canals. So as he moves his head, you can see the one in red is inhibited and the one in blue is activated.
Okay.
So that's what's actually happening. That's the positioning part of you. Okay. So it depends whether these canals, the fluid filled canals, is where the physical limitation is, or whether it's somewhere else. Okay. And you can see how the eyes integrate with that as well.
Yeah.
So the eyes integrate with that. So it's a very, very tightly integrated system. So yeah, it'd be interesting to find out a little bit more about that and whether something, an avenue you could look at to help improve. In terms of movement fluidity, obviously that's really important to know your environment. Definitely. Yeah.
Thank you.
Cool. Anything else? Nope. Cool. Okay. So next time I'll look at another aspect of running technique, and then depending on whether you want me just to, we can maybe look a little bit more into actually what do we do about posture. I could put some stuff together for that, or maybe put that between now and there and give that as a separate thing to do. And just look at another aspect of running technique, so we understand what it is, what some of those main markers are that we're looking for, and how it actually looks, and what it takes to achieve those things. Because that's obviously the key, is what can I do about it? How can I get that movement fluidity to make it look like I'm effortless? And I can guarantee you, for most elite runners, it's not effortless. It is a lot of effort. You're just going a lot faster for the same effort. They just make it look like, just make it look effortless, because their movement fluidity is so much better. Oh, and one of the other things I was going to say, actually, just on that, and talking about comparing ourselves to elite runners, is that what you'll find is that for anybody who's elite in anything, that sport, that activity, finds the elite, not the other way around. Okay, so we tend to be elite at what we're good at doing naturally, and that we then build on, because training is easier, we can get to the top much easier, so we have more motivation. So, you know, we can see this when we look at, even within a sport and the different disciplines within a sport. If we look at Mo Farah, for example, so Mo Farah, you know, when he was younger, he actually did football as well. He was a good football player, but he was not elite enough, but he turned out to be really good at cross-country running and then good at track running. So he became world-class, particularly at track running. And when he transitioned across to road running, he wasn't elite. His marathon times, of course, to us, he's elite, but his marathon times, they weren't competitive. So, and he did try a couple of goes at doing that and discovered he just wasn't elite enough. He couldn't choose that sport. And so he went back to track for a season and then he retired. Someone like Gabriel Selassie, for example, again, really good cross-country runner, really good track runner, an amazing road runner. So someone who could transcend those different disciplines. Okay, but most people can't do that. So when we compare ourselves to people who are really good at something, we have to recognize that in most cases, people that have got there have already got their systems are already in place. So they can do all these joint angle stuff. They can do all this capacity stuff. Then it has an impact because they've already got this stuff. Now, did they train it directly? They might not have had to. Might naturally all have really good balance systems or really good proprioceptive systems. Maybe they did lots of movement as a kid and within certain environments, and that just managed to translate across. So we have to just take into account when we're comparing ourselves to other people, and that, you know, I'm talking about elites, but it could be anybody around us, all of our systems work differently. So when you see someone who's better than you, have they trained really hard for that? And I would put myself in that position because I learned to run by numbers effectively. Okay. If I was a big coloring book, running for me was like that. And I trained each system individually. And I spent an awful long time over the years learning that the hard way. I wasn't what I would class as a natural runner. So I had to run by numbers to get there. Someone else could have come along. And it's great to see some of these youth athletes. And you see that difference in them. Some have to really, really try hard. And some of them just go, yeah, I'm just there. But then they reach a ceiling and then they then have to do that to get up to the next level. And it's just really interesting. And it's just, you know, when we're hard on ourselves, and I'm really hard on myself. And that's something Mark said to me, you know, about this whole Portland thing. You're just so hard on yourself. You set such a high bar. And I do. And maybe I need to take at least my own book on that one. But when we compare ourselves to other people, we have to, particularly when it comes to movement, is that they might have systems that are working better in certain contexts than we do. And if we want to be there, we probably can be, but we have to put the extra work in to get there. And I think once we accept that, we can then go, okay, well, maybe actually I don't want to do that work. I accept that I'm not going to get to that position that way, but I could go and do something else, or I might be really good at doing whatever it might be. And we can be elite, whatever elite means to us in that particular thing. So I think it's just reminding ourselves, I think, more than anything else. When we look at people who are the top of anything, whether it's sport, whether it's business, jobs, what's got them there normally is something that comes more naturally to them than to us. And we might have to work harder to get there if we want to get there. But we might just be better naturally at something else. And it's just it's human nature to compare ourselves to other people and to our own performance. But just something to sort of take into account. Okay, cool. Well, thank you very much. Enjoy your weekend, and I'll upload obviously this afterwards. I'll separate the audio out like last time and put that up separately, so you can go back and listen to it if you want to. Yeah, perfect. Any questions following it, just, you know, message me, and obviously, you know, what we've talked about, anything you want to take forward with that, then just message me, and I'm very happy to do that, and I'll start putting the next one together along with some of the other things. Oh, and if there's anything you think is missing from the membership that you think, God, I really want that to be in there, please tell me, because I'm building it for you guys, not building it for me, I'm building it for you guys. So if there's something missing, say, Chris, really want a course on this, even if it's a rough, can you do a lecture on this and stick it up there so I can go and learn about it? That's what I want that membership to be, as well as helping you progress through your running, is for you to go, I want to know this, tell me, and just tell me, and I'll either put it into a podcast or put it into a lecture or something. You know, obviously I like talking, so it's quite easy for me to do. Okay, thank you very much again, and speak to you later.
Okay,
thanks, you.
Chris.